Hello there. Today is on a Thursday on your weekly podcast, the Africa Climate Conversations. We're still on the Financing Change in Africa series. Karibu sana. Welcome. I'm your host, Sophie Mbogwa. The Financing Change in Africa series is a conversation made possible by a collaboration between the African Development Bank, the Climate Investment Funds, and the Africa Climate Conversations. So today we're having a very exciting conversation on just transition with Mike Ward, who will introduce himself in just a while. But before Mike does, we are asking ourselves how Africa can balance between its development plans and emission reduction, given that over 600 million people in Africa do not have access to electricity. Now, in 2009, the United Nations University Institute for Natural Resources had a report on Africa's stranded assets that warned that Africa must forgo burning 90% of known coal reserves, 34% of gas, and 26% of oil. So the question is, how can Africa avoid stranded assets, stranded workers, and stranded communities as the continent implements the Paris Agreement and develop at the same time? But countries like South Africa have had one of the most advanced national dialogues on just transitions. South Africa was one of the countries, actually the only country to mention a just transition in its initial nationally determined contribution, NDC, in 2015. So, what can African countries learn from South Africa, a country with long-standing coal dependence and also a high unemployment rate? Mike, thanks so much for joining this conversation. So who is Mike Ward?
Yeah, my name is obviously Mike Ward. I am South African and work from South Africa, but currently work for the Climate Investment Funds. Mm-hmm. Some of the background work that I've done in this sector was work with the various banking associations, the large commercial banks in South Africa, having a look at what kinds of skills would be needed for a just transition. Mm-hmm. And then more recently work with the Climate Investment Funds into South Africa, a case study on South Africa and just transitions, in which we look quite a lot at the investments that the African Development Bank have made into South Africa. We also did a case study on India and looked at some of the, particularly the big photovoltaic cells there. Mm-hmm. And now we're kind of moving into other case studies that we chat a bit about as we go.
Fantastic. And Mike, when you talk about just transition, what are we talking about?
So the way that we've been trying to understand just transitions, I mean, the one thing about just transitions is that there is no agreed upon definition. So it Sure. depends a lot on your interests, your perspectives. And so within the Climate Investment Funds, we set up something called the Just Transition Initiative with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. Mm-hmm. And started to look across many different definitions and draw out what we felt were common dimensions of just transitions. And two key dimensions came forward. The first one is around inclusion. So who gets to decide on what a just transition looks like? Who is recognized? Whose voices are heard? Really the kind of procedural justice dimension. The second dimension is around who gets what. So the distributional impact of these big changes that we see taking place and the decisions that we're making around climate action work. So those two dimensions we mapped out into a just transition framework. And then across both of those are elements of transformational change. So are we trying to reform within existing systems, or are we starting to acknowledge that some of the big social and economic systems that we have in the world may actually be underlying causes of unjust transitions, and therefore that we need to change or at least engage with those big social and economic systems? And that would be a much bigger transformational project. And so we're trying to kind of move from emergent transformational change, reform orientations, all the way through to advanced transformations that open up greater issues of equity and you know, equity both in terms of recognition and in terms of distribution.
Interesting. And we basically have the world has to stay within below 2 degrees warmer world, according to Paris Agreement, or aim to staying within, you know, get to at least 1.5 degrees. When we look into this part of the continent of the world, is that in terms of Africa, depending on where one is, there are some parts that are actually already warmer than actually the 2 degrees Celsius. In terms of when you look into the energy issues, because then majority of, like, we have still over 600 million people who still do not have access to energy. And Africa, it's one of the continents that is highly impacted when it comes to issues of climate, and adaptation is critical. But then again, majority of these countries at this particular time recording their natural resources, basically. When we talk about just transition, how do we ensure that we stay within where the world wants to stay in terms of the Paris Agreement, and also in terms of Africa develops?
Sure, it's such a great question, Sophie. You know, I think there's been some very useful work around how do we stay not only within the kind of climate impacts, but within a range of others, you know, loss of biodiversity, scarce water resources, some of the kind of nutrient loading that we see around phosphates and nitrates. So this notion of how do we stay within these broad planetary boundaries, and yet at the same time meet the social needs across a whole range of different issues, including things like education, access to water, access to food, access to energy, as you say. And the big challenge, I think, is to find these safe and just pathways within planetary boundaries while recognizing the social needs. And I think that much of the kind of discourse to date has been centered around almost an oppositionalization between this development on the one hand and low carbon development pathways on the other. And we see it come up over and over again. It's often stated as a balance between socioeconomic development and climate action. And I really think that this oppositionalization is based on the assumption that exploiting fossil fuel reserves is the cheapest way to address issues of energy poverty, as well as other development priorities in Africa. And my suspicion is that this assumption is no longer as true as it was. I think that new solar, particularly photovoltaics and wind, is cheaper than most coal-based energy.
Sure.
Energy storage costs are falling dramatically. And so it's extremely likely that the continued investment in fossil fuel extraction and related energy production will lead to stranded assets and stranded communities in Africa. Mm-hmm. So I think that what we need to do in Africa is recognize that we're in a way blessed, or we have these amazing natural resources beyond fossil fuels. And the importance of these natural resources for, like, local economies, local livelihoods. And I think that there's a strong case to be made for moving investment away from unsustainable extractives towards a sort of regenerative economy, an economy that rebuilds these ecosystems and societies to build resilience and to open up long-term sustainable livelihoods. So I think that it's a shift that's happening, and it's a shift based largely on the economics of renewable energy prices dropping below fossil fuel pricing, and it's going to shift the discussion significantly.
Yeah, and when you look into this particular now in this discourse, basically you find that moving to renewable, it's a fantastic way, and also in terms of making sure, as much as Africa contributes very little, but also it has to make sure that doesn't add on to the more carbon than we have in the atmosphere. But then the question of providing finance has been such a critical one, especially when it comes to the international discourses. And you find that moving to renewable, also the shift requires financing and money and technology. And much of these technologies when it comes to renewables are not, they are still owned by developed countries. So how do Africa make sure that in the shift, basically, do we look into more financing back at home? Do you look into the larger groups of youth that we have, ensuring that we equip them in terms of coming up with home-based solutions in terms of technology. Do we also look into terms of regional projects like the AFCFTA? How do we make sure that in this particular energy shift, we do not have a much coal, we do not invest in energy projects that will actually be harmful and will actually be not be useful in the shorter term? But how do we ensure that we do not end up with having stranded assets and also stranded workers and stranded communities? And also ensuring that we have technologies that they don't become overly expensive, that we do not, we're not able to maintain them in the shorter or in the long run.
Yeah, no, I think this is the big question. I think it's the answers to this that Africa and some of the Asian countries are providing are key, but they're also contentious. So if we talk about just transitions and we talk about things like distributional impact, one of the things that need to be considered are restorative justice issues around a history of contributions into CO2 emissions, as well as the kinds of possibilities that exist. And so restorative justice starts to raise important questions around who will, in a sense, take some of the responsibility for financing these transitions. And it's an important discussion to have. It's not a comfortable discussion, but it is absolutely vital. And the sort of common but differentiated responsibilities, the recognition that there needs to be concessional finance and support for the transitions in many countries in Africa, I think are important discussions. And so the kinds of contributions that, for example, the AFDB, in partnership with the climate investment funds, have made through partly concessional finance into, for example, the renewable energy projects in South Africa, early funding of the Sierra wind farm, early funding of concentrated solar power, and that kind of partly concessional funding, partly loan funding, really opened up the space for the renewable energy industry in South Africa. It still needs to be opened further, but that kind of almost pioneering work, taking some of the risk out of those initial investments, allowed the development of a renewable energy independent power producers procurement program in South Africa. And it also, I think, started to open up the path for private finance to see possibilities and to get involved in the transition to renewable energy. And as I've said, you know, with renewable energy becoming increasingly cheaper and very competitive with coal and other fossil fuel energy options, I think that kind of support needs to continue. We may not need concessional finance as much in some of the actual renewable energy, but we're certainly going to need it in, for example, building energy storage systems to take some of the variability out of renewable energy. So I think that there's both the need to recognize the need for restorative justice, as well as the importance of ongoing provision of carefully directed concessional finance and loan support from organizations like the Climate Investment Fund, Green Climate Fund, as well as the various multilateral development banks.
Thanks, Mike. And I want to actually stay within South Africa because South Africa's National Dialogue on Just Transition is one of the most advanced, basically, I would say, probably in the world. But the country has the long-standing coal dependence and high unemployment rates. In South Africa also, when it comes to national determined contribution, basically mentioned just transition in its initial NDCs. Tell us more a little bit about this whole just transition in South Africa and the lessons you've learned.
It's been a great history, and COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, were very early on board. I think 2011, they produced a policy document on just transitions in South Africa that articulated a very broad notion of just transition. And they've continued to work with it very carefully. And I think that for a while, maybe it became less prominent, but in about 2016, when Eskom, the large state-owned enterprise or state-owned utility on energy distribution, when they suddenly announced that they would be closing a number of coal-fired power stations and as a result the mines that supply them, the unions really stepped up and they stepped in and there were a number of protest actions. There were blockages of highways by some of the coal transporters groups. There was certainly a high court application by some of the unions to have the renewable energy independent power producers procurement re-looked at. And I think that it really lifted the discussion around just transitions. I will also say that the labor union is not necessarily a homogeneous group either. So the National Union of Mine Workers, NOM, for example, would have a position that is quite, I think, narrowly focused on protecting mine jobs. Whereas NUMSA, the National Union of Metal Workers South Africa, has a much broader and I think more useful orientation to just transitions, in that what they're saying is that we can't just have a transition of, for example, from coal mines and coal energy to renewable energy without thinking about who owns the energy production. What the purpose of that energy production is, you know, is it just to benefit some very energy intensive industries and small minority groups, or is it much broader development orientation in terms of providing access, more equitable access to energy? So I think that the just transition discussion, it has been around for a long time. It's now being picked up by more and more sectors of society. So we see government, as you say, including it in the first round of nationally determined contributions. I think the only country that did have just transitions reference. It has been picked up in our kind of planning documents. So we have a national development plan and an entire chapter there talking on just transitions. So it's very much part of the government discussion and discourse. Labor, obviously, I've mentioned. Civil society also picking up on it. And then increasingly business recognizing that we're going to need this just transition. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the exciting things that's happened is that we've put in place a national body that is responsible for bringing together these different social partners, business, government, labor, civil society, to discuss a just transition in South Africa. And it sits in the presidency. So it's the Presidential Climate Change Coordination Committee. And it, I think, will be a key body in allowing this discussion to go forward.
When it comes to that inclusion, do you think that it's actually going to really be helpful in terms of making sure that the communities, the workers who work in these mining industries and also the owners, basically, in terms of the businesses, they are protected? Because then again, when it comes to climate adaptation and also when it comes to energy access and these big projects, however small or big, I think it's very critical to make sure that communities on the ground be are protected and they're able, their livelihoods are protected and they are able to adapt as well and also ensure that these particular communities have access to energy, not just having big power plants. But also now, when whatever is done within countries has to also go to the grassroots. Do you think inclusion of the just transition and there being an empowerment of these particular all stakeholders involved, do you think it really will help in terms of making sure that all these groupings and communities are protected when South Africa, in terms of adaptation in South Africa and also energy access?
Yes, Sophie, such a great question. So in both the South Africa and the India case study, what became increasingly apparent was that it is relatively focused areas that will be most heavily impacted on by the transition out of coals and fossil fuels. In South Africa, it's Mpumalanga province, and within the province, probably three or four municipalities. Similarly, in India, it's probably three or four states in India in the kind of northeast of the country, that, well, central east, that, that will be impacted on. So one of the big discussions, and I think shifts that's happening, is this recognition that there needs to be a place-based response if we're going to achieve just transitions. So in terms of social inclusion, we need to identify people in these particular areas. We need to engage them in the discussion. They need to be able to influence the outcomes of what happens in these relatively focused areas. And so, yeah, it requires this very nuanced work on the ground in particular places, as you say, in local communities. And it needs to be careful work. You know, one of the things that can happen, particularly around, for example, gender considerations, mm-hmm. is that many of the coal mine workers are male. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the discussion could take place in male-dominated meetings where the coal miners are seen as the sort of main stakeholders. Whereas in the communities around the coal mines, it will be very heavily impacted on by the closure of coal mines. Many of the people bearing the brunt of, for example, yeah, keeping households going and developing local livelihoods are in fact the women. And so there's really this need to lift our gaze a little bit when we talk about, you know, local stakeholders and identify those groups that may not be immediately apparent but will be heavily impacted on by these transitions, and involve them very directly in the kind of just transition process. So in the process of who decides what a just transition may look like in these communities, and what fair distribution would look like around some of the benefits and harms.
Absolutely. What lessons do you think that other African countries can probably learn from the South African just transition and also the Indian study?
This is a long answer, but I think that there are seven areas that we're starting to identify as extremely useful for any country starting to look at a transition in order to make it more just. And the first is one that I've just touched on, you know, to identify the priority geographical areas based on the kinds of impacts and barriers and drivers of coal transitions. And it's going to be really important to map these strategic areas and to focus a lot of attention into those areas so that you can hear these local voices and they can influence local and national policy. I think linked to the geographic prioritization is also a need to look along value chains. So as I've said, you know, you can look at a coal mine, you can look at a coal mine and a coal power station. In South Africa, we very quickly learned that the transport bit of coal between the mine and the power stations was a major employer in the sector, and linked, of course, to the transport, all the people that maintain the trucks and the people that feed the truck drivers. There's a large sex trade around some of these activities. And so this need to map out an extended value chain to understand who's going to be impacted in the particular areas. So that's, I think, key. The other one is to establish working relationships and capacity building processes within and across national and state government departments. So this ability to, as I've said, have something like a presidential climate change coordination commission at a national level. There's the need to build capacity and conversations at a local level. And then there's a real need to link those two so that communities can have their voices heard in the national dialogue, and that national dialogue is sensitive and responsive to what's happening in local areas. So that building of capacity across these big dialogue areas, I suppose, is another one. And in order to do that, there's going to need to be a recognition and empowerment of often marginalized stakeholders. I've mentioned women, but you know, in South Africa, it may be particularly around race. So to recognize that there's deep racial divisions in these sectors, and to make sure that we don't further marginalize Black rural communities, for example, but to bring them in and to build their capacity to influence decision-making processes.
Mm.
So that would be key. I think one of the things that we see is very deep vested interests. And in the lack of, where there's a lack of good information, these vested interests, and I think there, for example, of people who maybe own a large number of coal mines, who are able to say to communities that if the coal mine closes, then all of their livelihoods disappear and they will be even more poverty stricken. I think we need to understand the bigger systems here. What impact are those coal mines having on, for example, soil fertility, on water quality, on air quality, on local communities? And so that kind of systemic modeling and scenario planning at a local level will help to address some of the vested interests.
Mm-hmm.
And linked to that, the need to kind of draw up priority activities, timelines, budgets, so that nobody gets caught by surprise with the sudden announcement of we're closing a coal-fired power plant, really does. And rightly so, you know, people are worried about their livelihoods and how they'll provide for their families and children. So to have long-term planning, to have budgets set aside for that, and to keep everybody up to date. And then a final point around needing frameworks, environmental and social frameworks in the banks that pick up on these many different dimensions, that support the monitoring and evaluation of the impacts of transformative initiatives, and then really support skills development to respond to a diversified economy in these particular areas. So skills, diversifying the economy and then building skills as well to keep track of what's happening in these areas.
Yeah. And I'm listening to you speak and I'm thinking in terms of to take care of this vested interest and actually empower these different stakeholders and also conduct research in terms of understanding different scenarios on the ground. There is a very importance in terms of funding. I'm wondering what roles do institutions like the AFDB, what role do they play in terms of the South African win and just transition process in South Africa in terms of funding? How much is it critical for African nations to be able to actually get probably into like get the just transition right?
So I think that very crudely, there are probably two levels at which the multilateral development banks can make a significant contribution.
Mm-hmm.
The first is a narrow one, and we saw it with the African Development Bank, for example, when it invested in the Siri wind farm or in the concentrated solar power initiatives in South Africa. There were strong commitments for, I suppose, what you could almost describe as corporate social investment in the area in which the projects were being developed.
Mm-hmm.
And that corporate social investment included things like building capacity amongst women's groups, supporting education in the area, from early childhood development all the way through to university education. So the recognition that there needs to be an investment over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And then contributed to the development of high-end skills so that local communities could start to work and to find employment in the various renewable energy industries. So, you know, that's a kind of local level contribution. It doesn't really talk to a bigger just transition, though. And so that's the second level, is that the multilateral development banks, the African Development Bank, have in a sense a mobilizing power for cross-sectoral dialogue. They're able to bring together sectors that might not normally talk to each other in a siloed kind of space, and to encourage a more sort of programmatic approach. And we see it in things like the country investment strategies, country investment plans that countries and the MDBs work on together. And I think in some of that planning to start to take a conscious focus or to place a conscious kind of emphasis on just transitions in these big transformative processes.
Thank you so much, Mike. Your final word.
a final word. I think that the transitions in energy systems, in a range of other systems, you know, in the African Development Bank also, for example, has sort of supported the Forest Investment Program, FIP, in Ghana. And I think that in many of these areas, we're going to see big transitions as we take conscious climate action, whether it be the inclusion of forests in things like REDD+ or in the nationally determined contributions. So the transitions across many sectors are inevitable. Whether they're just or not will depend entirely on our focus on ensuring social inclusion and being careful about distributional impact. And so it's going to take a conscious piece of work to ensure just transitions. The alternative, I think, is unjust transitions and you know, great suffering across many of the existing marginalized groups in our continent.
Mm. Mike, thank you so much. We have to end this conversation there, but I sincerely appreciate you taking time.
Sophie, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Remember, you can access other Financing Change in Africa series episodes on our website, www.africaclimateconversations.com, or listen to us on Spotify, Google, Apple, and every other channel you access your other podcasts from. Please write to us using info@africaclimateconversations.com or hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Now remember, the Financing Change in Africa series is a conversation made possible by a collaboration between the African Development Bank, the Climate Investment Funds, and the Africa Climate Conversations. I will see you next week on Tuesday when we start the restoration of the African Dryland series. But until then, kwaheri. My name is Sophie Mbogo.